Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Hello and welcome back to the Voice of Aroha podcast. I'm your co-host today, Alex Mabey, here with my other co-host, Ansh.
Hello, guys.
And today we're here with Rebecca. Can you please introduce yourself, Rebecca?
Kia ora, everyone. I'm Rebecca, and I am so honored and lucky to be here today. I got asked by the beautiful Sahar to come and join you guys, so yeah, I'm really excited.
We're excited to have you on. Now, we've heard from someone that you are from a third culture, or you're a third culture person. Can you please explain to us about being third culture or having three cultures?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, third culture kid, in the way that I see it, is that I grew up mostly in other parts of the world and then came to Aotearoa 13 years ago. And I'm, I guess, a little like amalgamation of so many different places. And when people ask me, oh gosh, where are you from? Because we hear that you've got an accent. I'm like, oh, well, I'm born in India, but my parents are from Belgium. And I lived in South Africa for 8 years, but now here for 13. And oftentimes I find myself thinking like, oh damn, that's like, it's not, I can't boil that down to like one answer. It's so intricate for me. So being a third culture kid is like, oh God, it's a very interesting, eye-opening experience that I feel like I and a lot of other people here live every day. But I don't mind it. I think it's a, I think if anything, there's a real beauty in it because we're so, one, molded into our society that we live in now, but we also have so much different, unique things to bring to the table. So, yeah. But in the same sense, like, when I meet other people who are also third culture kids, we have so much in common. And I'm like, oh my God, that happened to you too when you were growing up. So, yeah, that's what I mean by third culture kid.
Yeah, I think personally, I've never heard of the idea of third culture kid, but I now realize how much it relates to me. Like, I was born in the US, lived in Singapore, then moved here.
And oh, wow.
Just traveled between India and like my whole, whenever the question I was asked, like, where are you from? Like,
same
no
thing.
Clue, no
yeah.
clue. Based on that, being a third culture kid, would you say that shaped the way you like see the world or connect with other people?
Absolutely. If anything, it made me even more conscious that I had to figure out who I wanted to be in the spaces that I was welcomed in and the spaces I wasn't welcomed in. And I came here very fresh off the boat 13 years ago. God, I can't believe it's been that long. And I had the thickest South African accent. Like, I can actually go between my South African accent, but I really tried to unlearn it because when I came here, I went to Queenstown Primary. And for some reason, I wasn't sure why. I was at a very difficult stage of my life. I was 12 years old. I felt like the kids were bullies here and they were just mean to me. And I'm like, is it because of my accent? I don't know. So I really tried to unbraid that from my personality because I was like, how can I fit in? How can I fit in? And yeah, when people ask you, oh, where are you from? For me, now I see it as being, oh, it's okay. I can relate to you in this sense because I've had to figure myself up growing up here. And I guess, to me, it's like understanding the parts of me that I'm not afraid to show either. Because all the time when I was growing up, when I moved around the country, I had to also understand how different people viewed me. And for a really, really long time, this is going to sound really crazy as well, probably from how I got, I don't know, I don't want to say brainwashed when I was a kid, but in South Africa growing up, there were only maybe two other people in my class who were colored. And I went to a private school and it was a great experience. Like, my parents were, they gave me the best education that they could as well. But also putting me in those spaces that are very privileged, I learned how to have that kind of secondhand privilege, but also a firsthand experience of what it felt like to be a minority in that sense. And I carried that with me when I went to New Zealand. But what I didn't expect was to see actually a lot more diversity in New Zealand. However, when I left high school, came to Wellington, even more eye-opening for me, because Wellington is just like a flourishing hub of cultures. It's insane. But that little part of me that just didn't feel like I was truly belonged, only the last couple of years I really unpacked that and was like, oh, damn. Actually, you know what? I am cool. I am so powerful. I have a really freaking cool story to tell. I really want to open up that space for a lot of other people of color and third culture kids to talk about that. It's really important to me. So, yeah. Mm. A big explanation for yeah. that question.
All good. Yeah. Now, as a third culture kid, has there been any like special like moments or like fun things that happen because of your mix of culture?
I definitely feel that meeting people and understanding that, I guess, understanding coming from a very social, collaborative community in South Africa where I grew up in, to New Zealand, which was I felt was a bit more closed off, a little bit more individualistic. I mean, notwithstanding the fact that university was like probably the one moment in my life where I felt like I could just be safe to be me. It was figuring out those little hubs where I could go and comfortably express who I was. One really cool moment, though, and I have to say is, well, it's going to sound so cringy and so cliche, but meeting my partner, because I traveled to Malaysia for the first time last year, and something, I don't know if you can actually experience this in your lifetime or your reality, but I felt like I was a Malaysian in my past life because I just connected with the culture so much, something that I craved not having here for a really long time. And I, for example, I'm starting to learn Chinese. I cook Chinese food now. I'm really integrating myself into that culture, not only because it's for my partner and for me, because I want to have that carry on when we have children. Oh gosh, he's going to listen to this as well. Oh, but yeah, that's something I've never felt such an intense pull towards a culture before. And it kind of made me think like, oh, I wonder why that hasn't happened yet for me here when I'm living in New Zealand. But the beauty of that as well is that I'm always searching. I'm always searching for those things. And Wellington is such a gorgeous place because I keep finding little pockets of those moments. I do every day. Like, you guys, like, coming and approaching me, I was like, this is super cool. One, I didn't know the podcast exists here. But two, it's amazing that you guys get to have a platform to listen to my story, because I don't want to say in any way that I'm unique or special, because the purpose of me always wanting to share my story is finding people who can relate to that. And that has always been, if not one of those moments, that are really special to me. So, yeah.
That's great to hear your insights on that. And going back, you mentioned your parents were from Belgium.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you, to us, that you were adopted. Can you tell us a little bit more, like, I don't know, not really the journey, but just like the experience, I guess.
Oh, the experience? Yes. There's no easy way or one way to actually tell the story because, well, one, it's something that was always out of my control, but two, something that was also never hidden away from me. I think me being adopted, and maybe that's something as well for me to continue unpacking in my later adult life, because it's quite confronting. I don't know how to explain it. For example, if I were to tell people I'm adopted, the first question they always ask is, oh, do you know your real parents? And growing up, that was really, really difficult for me because I felt like, I mean, it's a really blatantly like forward and direct question to ask a kid. And I would always say, no, I don't know my real parents, but my parents are my parents. But even then, I didn't quite understand the magnitude of, one, not knowing who my birth parents were, and two, how that's going to affect me in later life. Because, and I don't want to get too, like, psychoanalytic in this, but understanding when you're growing up with mixed cultures is understanding where your roots are from, which has always been really integral to me, but I feel like a part of that seed I've just not been able to find yet. And that's when people ask me, oh, how do you feel about being adopted? I genuinely, I don't know how to explain it. I had a very, very beautiful upbringing. And I'm here now because of the support and guidance from my adoptive parents. And I have, actually, I do have one connection. This happened a few years ago where I was just scrolling through my Facebook and I found the person who took me in when I was, I was 18 months when I was adopted, but I was given away when I was a few days old, I believe. And she was the only person who'd ever seen my biological mother in person, which is huge. Because think about every day you wake up and you know what your parents look like. And then every time I look in the mirror, I have no idea if my mom looked like me, if I look like my dad, if I have siblings. It's a very, it's like an outer body experience, but so conflicting and confronting at the same time. And I've just taken it in my stride because I feel that I don't want to say, oh, that's the entire crux of my story, but it's another part of this, like, really multifaceted part of me that I feel also brings that unique element to my story. And my sister, actually, so I have a sister. She's turning 23. Oh my God. I just remember her as being my little baby sister. She's not blood related, but we also adopted her. And that was the one and only time I went back to India and visited my roots, so to say. And I was too young. I was 7 years old. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't feel like I had a good understanding of the importance of knowing my roots. And one thing that I would love to understand more of, and another part that's quite, I don't want to say conflicting either, but a lot of Indian people who approach me, they ask me, what part of India are you from? Do you speak Hindi? Or I've been taken for Fijian Indian. So I'm constantly crossing the line between, it's like being culturally ambiguous, I'm sure you understand, but like constantly going between that line of what people think I am and who I am. It's a very interesting experience to have. So yeah, and being adopted, like, boom, mic drop. That's like another whole part of that, right? Yeah. But I've never been actually unhappy about that. I think I'm a very lucky individual in the sense that I've heard stories of people who are adopted and it's just, hasn't gone well. They are either resentful of their adoptive parents or they feel completely isolated. Like no one knows, how to say, like they're battling this journey that no one will be able to relate to or understand. So yeah, I'm very lucky in the sense that I have the self-awareness, or at least I force myself to have that self-awareness to understand me. Yeah.
Do you feel like that being adopted has influenced how you navigate both your career and your personal life?
Oh, God. Do I feel like being adopted has helped me with my career and my personal life? It's actually always given me a bigger reality check in the sense that my father would always tell me that my life is going to be twofold. It's going to be, I'm a woman, and I'm also a person of color. Like, there's always going to be an extra hurdle for me to go over. And growing up, having to listen to that was, because I didn't really understand it at the time, I kind of just, I glossed over it. I was like, oh yeah, sure, I'm a girl. And I remember when I was at uni, oh my God, I was such a radical feminist back then. I was always preaching for, you know, I've got my rights and you know, screw the patriarchy and all that. And whilst a part of me used to be like that, I also felt like when I got out of uni, I had a lot more reality checks. And I realized, actually, I do just have the power to make it as I am. I don't have to find an excuse to blame something else bigger than me when I can also just navigate the world using the fact that I'm a person of color as my strength, or the fact that I'm a woman, because we're all freaking amazing as well, you know? So if I were to say, has it impacted me? Yes. But it's that twofoldedness that's actually more helped elevate me. And like I said, and I'm going to keep reiterating this in the podcast, is that I'm always wanting to hand the microphone over to other people, because if I can influence just one person to stand up and tell their story as well, for me, that's like, that's a massive win. That's huge. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, delightful. So a question I would have is, you mentioned Little Becca before.
Mm-hmm.
If you went back to Little Becca, what would you tell her? Any like advice on how to navigate this journey of life that you've been on?
Oh my goodness. This question is huge and intense, and it's going to take a little bit more than I probably anticipate to answer. Little Becca was fierce. She was bossing everyone around, and her teachers would always put on her report card, "Oh, lovely, lovely student, but a real chatterbox." And every time my parents would pick me up from school, I'd be like yapping away. I'm a professional yapper still. I love talking. But my teachers all saw in me that I was someone who just couldn't sit still. So I had to be creative. I had to do something. I was always, you know how when you get tasks when you're younger and you have to make groups and then you have to assign a leader? By default, that was always me. Like, every group I was in, it was like, Rebecca's a leader. So I was like, yes. And I took that role. And I remember when I got older, I was like, oh, I wasn't bossy. I was just assertive. And I had to not see that as a negative. And little Becca, thinking that she could, you know, rule the entire world, she grew up with so much confidence that nothing seemed impossible to her. And then as she got older, things happened like, how do I make this not cringy? Growing up, and then I was never the cool girl. I was the studious one. I was the goody two shoes, and that became so much of my persona. I just embraced it. But in a similar vein, I was also no one's crush. And growing up as a girl as well, like, or even just growing up in general, like when you have crushes on people, like I always thought it was because of the way that I looked, that I wasn't attractive. Girl, that was like the hardest thing for me to accept, that growing up, I never really felt truly beautiful. And I, until very recently, was able to find the power within that and be like, no, actually, I love myself as I am. I've got a lot of work to do still, as everyone does. I'm a work in progress. But little Becca, if I could tell to her today something and hold her hand and say something to her, I would just tell her, hey, you got this, because I know right now everything seems messed up, but you're going to be able to reach so many people in your life, and there's going to be friends that are going to teach you a lesson, and then there's going to be people who are going to really hurt your feelings, and it's not always going to be you, it's just going to be them too, but everything, you take in your stride. And little Becca would probably be like, I know that. She'd be like this sassy, bossiest queen. And I'd be like, I know you know that, Becca. And she's stubborn. Little Becca has been stubborn all the time. So I'd be like, okay, you're going to meet someone as well who's going to, you know, humble you. So just make sure you keep that open mind. That's what I would tell little Becca.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now you've been talking through the podcast how you want like a... make a space for like those of like those kids who are obviously third culture kids, mm-hmm. and putting the microphone out to like people to hear the stories of, mm-hmm. about their voices. Do you have any plans of actioning that or making a space like that?
So currently I'm on a small career break. I have been looking at creating some spaces where I can do collaborative work with not only, I want to say, people of color, but also women who, like me, have struggled with, for example, finding the right resources for holistic health or how to take care of their bodies when different parts of their cycle, resources that little Becca just had no idea where to find. And I also am trying to, for example, with my social media, I always think that I'm not really a content creator, but I swear to God, I'm chronically online. A lot of people tell me that. But I just love being creative. I like putting I don't mind if it's cringy and I'm making these videos, but it gains traction. And a lot of my friends, they always message me about it. And one thing that I would really love to do as well, which I've tried and I've dabbled in it, is to have a little podcast as well of my own. But right now, yeah, I'm in the process of creating a plan where I can have a space where we do journaling workshops, meditations, that we have resources brought to you by local artists or people of color for people of color. And it's interesting because my thought process behind that was also twofold. I was like, one, am I going to be ostracizing a whole group of people? And two, it's something that I feel like is it's a gap, and I can see that we need that as well. Just much as the same as someone wants to create a product for curly hair. I obviously can't use it because I don't have curly hair, but they feel so strongly about it because they know that's something that they wish they had. So I thought to myself, actually, you know what? I'm not going to back down and have that, what is it, imposter syndrome, being like, oh, and maybe it's not going to work, da 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 da. So yeah, I'm putting 110% of force behind this. So yeah, watch this space. And it would be a beautiful thing to have in Wellington. Oh my God, I can't imagine it. So yeah.
I can 100% imagine that in Wellington, like just in the CBD. 100%.
I'm manifesting.
Yeah, I believe in you. And on a little bit of a sidetrack,
mm-hmm.
it just seems like throughout the entire podcast that you've actually like genuinely had no fear in public speaking or putting yourself out there. And I just like personally wanted to ask, have you ever had like moments of fear, or like what is this drive that allows you to be so open in public without that, you know?
Okay. I can give you the answer to that. And that is not having a cell phone until I was 18. So I wasn't allowed a phone until I went to uni, and that pretty much forced me to be social. I would email my friends for playdates, and that was it, like be there or be square kind of thing. And also, like I said, little Becca was just unabashedly her. She was always so confident. She wanted to just, the world was her oyster always. And I had my own speech club when I was in high school. I remember it was year 13. I completed my year 12. I got all my credits that I needed. And I was like, cool, year 13, it's just going to be my cruise year. So I decided to open up my own speech club. I did Toastmasters for a little bit as well. And I had my own students. And I remember I was highly competitive. I still am. I feel like I've been humbled a lot more after university, but I was cotton-wooled in that high school because we were so small. And if you had accolades and you have your badges and stuff, people would like laud you and praise you. So there was me walking around school with my like 20 badges being like, yes, I'm going to have a speech club of my own. And I actually won the speech fest that year after 3 years being second. I mean, that's how competitive I was. I was like, nah, last year, year 13, go out with a bang. And yeah, I remember though there was one point in my life where I do think that me always being so social had a couple of drawbacks in the sense that I had to learn who I could trust and the people that had, like, not to say malicious intentions, but just understanding where there was space for me to be myself, and then also, I guess, where I had to just, like, not keep my guard up, like, keep my guard up a little bit. And yeah, just I honestly think I should just put professional yapper on my resume, because that's what I love doing. I love talking. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah, I can relate to, like, having all the badges and awards and things and stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got so many badges on my school blazer. Now, every career has its ups and downs. Mm-hmm. What has been some of your biggest challenges you've faced, and how have you overcome them?
With career?
With your career, yeah.
I'm 25. I don't even have I had a career? No. I had a small mini dose of, like, feeling that I wasn't 100% welcomed in some of my jobs. I had a very how do I even put this? My first job out of uni, I should have seen the red flags, as they say. I should have seen all the red flags with management hierarchy. Older ladies that just for some reason just couldn't stand me. And I was like, look, your insecurity ain't my problem. But having to actually navigate that as well and actually say, you know what, I can't take this all personally all the time. There are going to be a lot of times where people are just not going to like me. And I need to be okay with that. In terms of, like, really, really big pitfalls or obstacles, I've just removed myself from those spaces. I've had times where I've had to come home and vent at my partner and he's just had to listen to it. And I'm like, you know what? Actually, if I'm contracting, it's not the end of the world. I'm not even going to meet the... If it's not something that I have to worry about, like, in 5 minutes, there's no reason for me to worry about it in 5 years' time, you know? So I've just removed myself from spaces I didn't feel welcomed in. That is a huge privilege. I understand not everyone can do that. But I've also just been so headstrong growing up in that multicultural medium where I've had to accept it's okay. It's only for the better. And with my last job now, I've just decided, you know what, it's time for me to realign my focus, my goals, what I'm really passionate about. So I wrote what I'm passionate about. And now I know it's all me. It's all good. So, yeah, I'm really excited for the next part of my life. 25! Oh my gosh. No, actually, sorry, I'm turning 26. But yes. Yeah, I'm so... I feel like I have an old soul. My knees are definitely in their 40s. From all the jiu-jitsu and gymming, but yes, no, I'm super excited.
I heard you do jiu-jitsu. Can you tell us a little bit about how that's, like, influenced, I guess, the way you go by life?
Yes, absolutely. So I started jiu-jitsu 2 years ago, and I, like every noob white belt, went in there just being spastic, like in the sense that you're just there, you have no spatial awareness of your body. And the first thing that I learned very quickly was you have to be super comfortable with being uncomfortable. And that is, to me, in every day or already for me, that's like a huge valuable lesson that I, not only when I get off the mat, but when I step on the mats don't lie. And if, I don't know, when you've done a martial art for a few years, you realize every single stripe or every belt is like 3 to 5 years dedication. So that's the other thing, consistency, it's taught me. And also, you're gonna have to suck to be really good. And a lot of people shy away from that as well because they're like, hey, I don't wanna have failure in my life because that makes me uncomfortable. And then you realize that a lot of people get cotton wooled. I was a cotton wool child all the time. And again, the reason I loved to do all of my extracurricular stuff is because I thought if I'm excelling and no one's telling me that I'm not doing a bad job, I'm just going to keep going, that I just, like, you shut out the criticism, and that's where it gets really dangerous. But with my jiu-jitsu, it's right there on the mat every single time that I go on there. I can't be like, I mean, sometimes I do, but I can't be like, oh, this guy just like put 100 kilos on me, because they do. But then I'm also having to use my technique. And then it gets to that part where I'm like, okay, they are 50 kilos heavier than I am. But at the same time, I've been training for 2 years, so I need to start using my technique. So it's actually navigating that like inner like dialogue in your head about, oh, I just want to find an excuse for the reasons that I'm not doing well, when it is you. A lot of people don't like to hear it, but I'm sorry. You are the problem. No, you are fully in control of being able to switch your mindset in that sense. We do meditation as well. My coach, he's always asking us to meditate at least like 2-3 times a week. He gives a lot of nutritional information as well. Even for me, being one of the only females in the dojo as well, it's just me and then a couple of like stray people that come in. And I really have to be like, when they come in, not to be like, excellent, because we have such a small female presence in a very male-dominated sport. And that's also taught me the value of community. I think it is really scary going in there the first time, but all the men there are so respectful. And it also broke that kind of facade for me, thinking that everywhere I go, that I always have to be extremely aware of myself, what I look like, how I act around different men as well. But then you do see that other side of the respectful nature, the inclusivity. Like, they will always ask me, oh, after a role, how do you feel about that? And to me, that's really important, because of course they want to keep the girls coming, right? So it's taught me the value of community, consistency, and also how to feel really, how to sit with discomfort, how to seek it and how to sit with it. And that is something that I think is such a, I wish everyone could have like 10 minutes of sitting with the worst discomfort of their lives, just to be able to know what that feels like, because it's going to happen. You're going to have to learn how to control it as well. I used to have like a lot of stress and anxiety back at uni, and that was a really tough time for me. I didn't have resources for understanding what's going on, why am I feeling this way. And now I just, when I'm on the mat and I start to feel like, oh no, I'm getting anxious, I don't want to roll with these guys, I take myself off the mat. It's that mental game as well. And I'm like, okay, I just need to do some big, deep breaths. And then I get back on. And then I feel good, because I'm like, yes, I was able to channel that for myself. But I mean, it's hard for me to do that. Like, if I'm on Lambton Key and there's so many people, I'm like, oh, this is just too overstimulating, I'm just taking the bus next time. But yeah, that's what it's taught me for the most part. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're now coming to the end of the podcast. Mm-hmm. A tradition here at Voice of Aroha is that each guest will put a question for the next guest to come on.
Oh, so, wow.
We have a question from our previous guest.
Oh, gosh. Oh, this is so cool.
Here it is. If you can make a positive change in your community today,
Which one would it be?
Which one would it be?
Well, something that I definitely feel like we've had conversations about, and something that's kind of right on my doorstep as well, living in Newtown, is I want to see way more attention for homeless people. That's an entirely huge, huge space to go into. And even for me, like, being on a career break, like, I have so many, because I'm educated, because I also have, I guess, a certain status as well. I'm a taxpayer. I can go into a Ministry of Social Development, sitting on that privilege, and actually ask for help and get that. But I see so many, and I've even, you know, talk to some homeless people, being like, hey, there is help and support for you. I can, you know, help you if you want. But it's actually, it goes down on that granular level, and I can't even begin to collate all of this into one answer for you. But yes, just more, just support for people who are homeless. There has to be a better infrastructure to support that, even with policies that we have right now. I know Tamitha Paul talks about this a lot as well for social housing, but even that needs to be completely ripped apart and put back together on good foundations. So yeah, that's something I need to see, especially knowing I'm going to have kids as well. And I want them to also be able to know that we have a community that can make tangible change. It's not just all talk. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Well, thank you for coming on the podcast, and thank you for watching. See you next time.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks, New Zealand On Air, for funding accessmedia.nz.